listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, on the line, and I'm going to give them an introduction. I'm going to give Dacker's introduction, and Hunter's going to give Daron's introduction. But I always, these are two authors and two thinkers, and I spend a great deal of time saying the following. You know, there's a great book by Dacher, but I usually say Dachner Keltner. and then I go on, or I say, well, the seminal book to read really on this subject is a book by Darren Acemoglu called Why Nations Fail. But anyway, Dacher Keltner is our, one of our guests, a professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley, where he directs the Berkeley Social Interaction Lab. I know you work with Facebook as well. To amazing books that he's written, best-selling book, Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and The Compassionate Instinct.
And also Born to Be Good.
Yeah, I said that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
no,
you didn't. You were spacing
out.
Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, and The Compassionate
Instinct. I was so nervous about when I start speaking my lines.
Well, he's also published 190 scientific articles. The man's busy. All right.
Yeah.
Busy thinking and writing things down. And then there's Daron Acemoglu, because and I love that you're Turkish born of Armenian descent.
Correct. Yes.
A great deal of turmoil that goes on in your heart. So please.
I know. I am totally ruthless.
with yourself. Well, go ahead, Hunter. Give us who Daron is.
He, besides winning the John Bates Clark Medal, the John von Neumann Award, and the Erwin Plein Nemers Prize in Economics.
The Nemers Prize, damn it.
He's also the Charles P. Kindleberger Professor of Applied Economics at MIT.
Yeah, and he wrote a book called Why
Nations
Fail, which we talk about all the time. Dacher and Daron, we really do talk a great deal about your work and
oh no, thank you very much. We're really flattered.
Well, it's not flattered.
I should only add that I did not write Why Nations Fail by myself. I wrote it with my dear co-author and friend, collaborator James Robinson. So,
yes, I should have
mentioned all of the credit or the blame. You know, if you're gonna start throwing blame, you know, he's to blame.
I should have done that. And Hunter and I were talking about how to start this conversation. And Hunter, why don't I think what we were really talking about was, it seems to me that, you know, in your book, Why Nations Fail, you talk about how important institutions are, the credibility, the integrity of institutions in a country, and you do a very good job of arguing for that. It isn't so much access to resources, et cetera. It really is more the discipline of a country's institutions. Dacher, I think that you essentially in many ways prove through your work, or at least, you know, you make a very strong argument that in many ways, you know, democracy, as we think of it, freedom, individual freedom, is really a human condition. It's sort of how we've evolved. It sort of makes human sense. It's sort of synonymous in many ways with our human nature, even though, yes, you can point to many examples throughout history and even today, obviously, of people who are capable of incredible selfishness and cruelty and all these different things. But for the most part, it seems to me you're making a case for the fact that behaving, and you use this great sort of Confucius notion of Zen, which is sort of tilting the scales toward making not only yourself but your neighbors and everything around you a better place, is really not only the way to go, but probably ultimately where we are moving toward anyway, almost without... doing so, I guess, in a way that's sort of natural. So I guess what are we trying to say here, Hunter? We're trying to say essentially that it seems that you're both arguing for the fact that the best system of government is democracy.
Yeah, and I think the important thing is that, you know, when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, or when the Founding Fathers were framing the Constitution, they could only guess at human nature. And the interesting thing is that now, because of people like Professor Keltner, you know, we have real insights into how human nature works. And now we can check, oh, does our system of government and, you know, is our economic system based on an honest and accurate reflection of how human beings actually work?
And how their biology works.
Yeah.
Right, Dacher?
Yeah.
Right, Professor?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a a very forward-thinking and ambitious summary of what we've learned about the evolution of human nature. I mean, we know when you look into the nervous system and then you look at the patterns of social behavior of our hunter-gatherer predecessors or individuals living in the conditions of our evolution, you find tremendous egalitarianism. You find an ethic of respect. You find a privileging of each individual's democratic expression of opinion. So you see these kind of old human forces as being part of our evolution. And the thinking in the psychological sciences is that the institutions that Durand talks about that make for healthy nation states grow out of these basic behavioral patterns of, you know, trade and cooperation and mutual respect and the expression of the kind of dignifying of other people's opinions. And I think the question that we can ask is, how well do nation states honor those very old social instincts?
Well, they I think Durand's work also could make the argument that institutions and their integrity are what keep power run amok in check. You know, you've done some work on the psychology of power, how it changes the brain. People who are in luxury cars are less likely to stop for pedestrians, which is incredible. and so, you know, people are going to behave a certain way. We are bipolar apes. I mean, sometimes we're capable of incredible generosity, other times incredible cruelty. But institutions are what seem to keep the human animal somewhere in the golden mean. Durand, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think you've really framed the question extremely well. But I want to sort of push the conversation forward a little bit by sort of asking, you know, Dacher about, you know, how to sort of think about this in some sense a little bit more sort of historically, because, you know, I mean, I think, you know, this view of humans behaving at their best in consultative, you know, participatory, pluralistic environments is very much consistent with the way that we read, you know, some of the history. But
right.
the problem, in some sense, that is a little bit tougher for me to understand, and I think that might be useful for your listeners, too, to put it into perspective. You know, even though, you know, in many stateless societies, not all, so far as I can understand, you know, there was that sort of egalitarian ethos, that wasn't sort of a natural thing in some sense, it seems that way, that they had to work very hard to maintain it.
Yeah,
but
they do.
But more importantly, you know, for the sort of intervening, you know, 20,000 years or whatever, at least 10,000 years after and around the Neolithic Revolution, the majority of the human race actually lived under a very, very, very different system, which was not participatory, much more authoritarian, much more hierarchical, much more based on some people just like in their luxury cars, not stopping for others.
Yeah.
But and humans seem to have adapted to that extremely well also. So it's not as if, like, we are such democratic animals that we cannot adapt to that hierarchy. We've adapted to that extremely well.
Yeah.
So I want to sort of see how to sort of link these, and then perhaps then we can start linking them to the sort of the institutional way that James and I try to sort of think about it.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, Durand, I absolutely agree, and I think that, you know, egalitarianism is hard work. And if you look at, for example, Christopher Bum's summary from the anthropological literature, what he finds, and also Franz de Waal notes in some of his studies of non-human primates, our close primate relatives, is what people are calling leveling mechanisms, which is that social entities or social collectives implement certain kinds of social processes like accountability and public scrutiny and gossiping and reputational damage and even, you know, isolating individuals within social tribes to do the hard work of preserving sharing and cooperation and egalitarianism. And I think that the, you know, the really interesting problem that you're raising, Durand, is that, as you suggest, you know, something happened in a lot of human societies that I think we're now just slowly in some parts of the world countervailing, which is, and a couple of Michigan archaeologists have talked about, as we started to settle into interconnecting tribes, as we developed a bit of agriculture 8 to 10,000 years ago, you saw this shift out of egalitarianism towards rigid hierarchies, lineage-based hierarchies founded on some interesting things that are worrisome today, like slavery, patriarchy, religious ideology that tends to sanctify some individuals over others. So I think we got this really interesting tension of forces, of the force of egalitarianism, which I think is part of our democratic evolution, and then these countervailing forces of inequality.
Well, let me jump in for a second, because I think that they've done some studies on, and I just from you can see how men behave. I can't speak for women, but in men, when men get
together, behave better.
Well, no, they definitely don't, but they certainly delineate authority very quickly. You see it, and it works. So, in a hunting party, they delineate authority quickly. In a if they're at war, authority is delineated very quickly. And men can sense who the alpha, who the toughest guy is, who's the most effective killer, who's the most effective lock picker, whatever it might be. We suss that stuff out very quickly. And I feel like, you know, I just came from the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship. I was sitting cage side watching that violence. It's as close as you can get to watching two men kill themselves with their bare hands. But it is true that the champion gets the spoils. The champion gets the women. The champion gets the money. The champion gets all the attention. He's the alpha, and he's got a team around him, and they follow him around, and everybody has their role in that team. You're not winning a championship without having a team behind you, and everybody has their job to do, and they do it often without even talking. They just, men kind of fall into that place. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yes, we have an egalitarian bent in some instances, but I feel as though if you look at history, we are authoritarian animals. And
perhaps a different way of saying that, and this was, I was going to sort of pose this question as a follow-up question to Dakar, is perhaps an alternative is that we actually have multiple modules evolutionarily developed, that we have a module for being participatory, pluralistic, democratic. We have a module for dominating others if we are powerful enough. We have a module for following authority and being scared of authority and hierarchy. And then which one of these modules sort of are activated depends on the institutions, depends on the social, economic, and political organization of life, and of course where we find ourselves within that hierarchy.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's a very compelling analysis, and I think that, you know, the it's clear we're a hierarchical species. You know, from starting from age 1 and 2, people know, like as you're saying, Brian, people know who has the stuff of the alpha, and they will arrange themselves into hierarchies. We also have these strong, you know, as Josh Green and others are starting to document, David Rand, that we do have this. And Henrik and others, this sort of slight bias towards sharing inequality. And Durand's point is often lost sight of in conceptual analyses of hierarchy and inequality and power, which is it's the properties of the social collectives and institutions that will tilt human groups toward these different modules of hierarchy or egalitarianism.
Say that again. Dakar, what do you mean by that? I'm sorry.
Well, you know, if you look at, you know, the way that we approach it is we quickly veer toward Stalin-like, you know, despotism and hierarchy. If you take away certain institutions, it doesn't take much, right? If you can't openly comment on other people's behavior, if you don't have if you don't have a journalistic form of scrutiny, if you don't have the free flow of information, if you don't have the honoring of people's voices, those institutional practices will quickly tilt human behavior towards more coercive forms of hierarchy.
Yeah, and I think what I really like about all of your work, both you, Durand, and yours, and David Sloan Wilson, is that it seems to me that you guys are, in many ways, making a very strong argument for the fact that altruistic groups, I mean, David Sloan Wilson talks about how selfish behavior within a group, you're going to win. You're going to get all the spoils and the money and the girls or whatever you want to call it. But altruistic groups, when a group behaves in an altruistic manner, in sort of a more of a, as you're talking about, more of an egalitarian manner, they tend to be more productive. They produce more offspring, etc., than the selfish groups. And for me, you know, when I look at sort of the institutions that of the countries that work that Duran kind of highlights, and then I listen to your sort of as you're talking about how sort of egalitarian how people tend to how that is probably the best way to go. It feels as though there's no question that democracies as we know them in this country are just more powerful in the end. They're more productive. They're more powerful. It is the argument. It is a better way to live. It is sort of the way you solve the political problem.
Right, but I think that's absolutely right. But I think the key question, a key question, not the key question, but a central question is, you know, whether that is so natural a state that we are almost inexorably going to gravitate towards it, or whether it takes a lot of work in institutions.
It doesn't, but Duran,
so I think it's the latter is very important. So I think sometimes, you know, people I respect a lot, like David Sloan Wilson and, you know, E.O. Wilson, Joe Henrich, and others, you know, they emphasize this sort of group dynamics that hold the group together a lot in a, just the right way. But perhaps a simplistic reading of that emphasis could be, well, that's so powerful that it's going to arise and it's going to carry. But we know, you know, a myriad of examples of where it doesn't work that way, you know, from sort of Banfield's or Putnam's work of entirely sort of amoral behavior within a community that you don't care about anybody else to sort of one group dominating another, you know, all of these things, you know, modern society tries to deal with them by developing the right set of institutions, and it's really hard work to maintain these institutions.
Well, it is hard work, but I think what I'm saying is that I agree with you. I don't think this happens naturally, but I think what happens is you guys are starting to win the argument. Look, I mean, the founding fathers who came up with the Constitution, that was an argument that hadn't been around before that in many ways, and that the idea of democracy as it's spelled out in the Constitution was very difficult to argue against. And I feel as though when I read, you know, your book, Dacher, or I read your book, Duran, you're making the argument that yes, if we have a tendency to behave in an authoritarian way, in a selfish way, well, guess what? It's going to be counterproductive. And if you disagree with that, see the work of Dacher Keltner, see the work of Duran Osmoglu and his colleague. That's kind of what I think is so valuable about this and getting you guys together and talking about this, because I think it requires, you know, people like yourselves, your ideas to get out there so people can see that you're making a very, very difficult argument to argue against. That's kind of what I think.
Right. No, I think that's right. Thank you. I think that's absolutely the way I would like to read it too. But I also sort of want to emphasize as we go along that the alternative is very much alive and kicking, that any society, even with the most admirable set of democratic practices, can, with some ease, transition into something much worse.
Yeah, that forms even, of, I mean, I think, you know, I think Duran's point is I, you know, as a caveat is really worth your listeners contemplating, which is that, you know, you could take the literature that we've been using as a foundation of our cooperative tendencies. We'll share 40% of a resource. We show a lot of altruism towards strangers as sort of leading to the conclusion that strong social collectives are just natural and easy. And I think history tells us that the institutions that now build up strong nations are a lot of hard work. You know, I was really struck by Tony Jute's observation, and I worry with respect to Duran's argument about the United States, where some of our institutions are very frayed and poorly developed and unsophisticated, like our criminal justice system right now is really being examined quite seriously, rightfully so. And Jute's argument is really Duran's argument, which was that, you know, what the U.S. needs is to recognize that we have to devote a lot of resources and effort to the public good and to the institutions that make up the strong social fabric. And it's not an easy intuition here.
Well, the problem, because the problem is, when I hear you say that, the problem is that it's loaded, because now I hear you know, I hear a bunch of people saying, that means you got to raise taxes and create a bigger welfare state. And I wonder if, you know, that's going to be a tough sell, because we've tried that before. It's been tried in the extreme in many of the socialist countries and communist countries we're talking about. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we have to be careful of. We have to reward productivity and hard work.
But I think the point is that, you know, Dacher's words were that we have to devote a lot of effort and energy.
He's
and
a communist.
No, he's
got a subversive haircut.
Yeah.
All those books behind him, whatever. Keep going.
But I think the point is that it's effort and energy. And I mean, there's a big difference between, you know, financial resources and psychological energy. And, you know, obviously, given Daron's background, you know, he understands how fragile institutions are and how quickly places can destabilize. And I think, you know, you and I have lived all over the world, and I think it's more of a mindset of really appreciating democracy and then always being vigilant to make sure that every aspect of that democracy is operating at the optimum possible level.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that, I mean, you know, we're now transitioning to something, you know, quite different, you know, the U.S. case. So I don't know how much we want to go into that. But the U.S. case is very difficult because, you know, you have a set of institutions that have evolved, you know, over time, and they really, you know, have certain properties that are just ingrained in them because of historical reasons. So if you look at many of the problems that the U.S. has right now, you know, it comes from, you know, a historically evolved process in which states are so powerful, and they decide law enforcement, they decide many economic activities, regulations, whether you can have car dealers, whether you can have occupational licensing, whether, you know, schooling is provided in this way or that way. And all of that is a consequence of the development of the U.S. political and economic system, where, you know, there was rightly a great suspicion about the power of the federal government, because, you know, you saw how the sort of all the absolutist projects led to terrible outcomes in Western Europe around that time, and the states, you know, the original units did not want to subjugate themselves to that all-powerful federal government. They were supposed to be there as a check on those things. But today, you know, we have other ways of trying to check the federal government. We still have the states as, you know, useful experiments. The governments can do a lot of things, but then they also have all these old vestiges that are really very difficult for building a functioning welfare system, having a coherent, you know, law enforcement policy. And all of that is something that, you know, we have to deal with, we have to tackle.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true, but I think the interesting thing is that the U.S., for the U.S. example, obviously, yes, we are trapped by that history, and that history is, you know, a mythological religious reverence for the Founding Fathers and the Constitution. I think what's been really interesting for Brian and I, just because we are sort of flaneurs through, like, modern thought, is that we keep on seeing again and again that so many areas of public life are being reexamined in light of neuroscience, psychology, evolutionary theory, and that there's the possibility that we realize that ultimately, you know, we are stuck with the biological endowment we got for 100,000 years ago or more, and that essentially, you know, you can't, like, that is the foundational text. The foundational text is not the Constitution, it's human biology, and then you have to look at that and reevaluate it. In terms of criminal justice, we recently interviewed Adam Benferrato, who wrote this awesome book called Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice, that reexamines all of criminal justice in the light of neuroscience. And one of the great studies that he shared was, you know, they studied this Israeli parole board, and the biggest determinant of whether you were given parole was whether they had had lunch Yeah. How recently yeah. they had eaten.
Yeah.
Because essentially all of that willpower stuff, you know, if there were
a
two
men. A thin man is more likely to find a heavy set woman guilty.
Yeah.
Just because she's heavy set. I mean, there's so many examples of this. You wouldn't believe it. It's such yeah. an amazing, the data's out there.
But once you recognize, I mean, that's the point. I think that once we all start saying, oh, let's go check with biology, let's go check with neuroscience as our sort of, that's our touchstone. Then I think we'll be able to start to reshape those U.S.
But
institutions
to piggyback what you're saying, Hunter, I want to ask Dacher a question about that. You do a lot of experiments, and you know you make, and it seems that your experiments have pushed you in the direction of sort of realizing that human beings have a great deal of compassion. There's a big side of them that's generous and compassionate and everything else. Do you think though that is because, for the most part, the argument that you're making has already begun to take hold over the years? Do you think that if you were to do your experiments on a tribe of Mongols, and even if you're asking them to behave within their own context, their own tribe, do you think they'd behave the same way? Or do you think our biology has already, is being influenced, whether we know it or not, by the philosophies and religions and mythologies and examples we grow up with? By the time we're, you know, adults, we've been pretty indoctrinated into behaving well. What do you think, Dacher?
Well, I mean, in part, the studies have been done, Brian. So, you know, Doron referred to Joe Henrich as this very elegant study about how much we share, which yeah. is a close relative of compassion. And you find in, pre-industrial cultures that there is a lot of sharing. The independent the society, the more you see sharing. So. Yeah. So clearly it's there. Compassion is there. So it's part of our evolutionary heritage. And at the same time, you know, we recognize enormous plasticity that, you know, today we feel compassion towards people of different gender identities. And only 30 years ago, that was unimaginable.
That's
and
right.
those groups were.
So, I mean, I think again, I think that, you know, not being an expert, but still trying to think through these things, I would like to emphasize a slightly broader interpretation, which is that we have compassion, but it sort of coexists with vindictiveness, anger,
yeah.
Cruelty, and the question is, which one of these feelings are being ignited by the context, by, you know, like, for example, you know, Dacher talked about the sort of stateless societies where a lot of our psychology evolved. And, you know, Lawrence Keeley's work, for example, sort of suggests that those guys were just an order of magnitude more violent than our, the 19th century forefathers of ours, which we always think of like always fighting. So, you know, they just kept killing each other, both across tribes and within tribes, probably. So the compassion and the egalitarianism coexisted with an untold amount of human misery created by violence. And
yeah.
why? Well, because there was no institution for
yeah.
sort of creating, solving disputes, even within tribes, if those disputes are not, you know, the regular sort of fair that they could deal with easily. And there were certainly no institutions dealing with anything between tribes. And all of those things were just, resorted to violence.
Mm.
Well, I think being in Berkeley, I'm always painted as, you know, the mind is only compassionate. Of course, you know, there are hierarchical tendencies, there are genocidal tendencies, there are, you know, there are tendencies towards sexual violence that are part of the great mix. And I think, you know, I think that how we would think about it as psychologists is that they're going to be kind of these properties of social collectives, small social collectives of 50, 100 in hunter-gatherer groups that I've been talking about, that have that are the kind of the raw materials. I don't know if you agree with this, Doron, of the institutions we need to work on today, like the institution of open public commentary or journalism has its roots in the gossip and rumor mongering that you see in every human social group. So absolutely.
I think it's exactly the right way to think about it. And I think, you know, let me put it somewhat differently. So, you know, I am sometimes asked by, you know, various people, economists or generally non-economists, you know, whether, you know, the problem with the, you know, we have with the economic system, why there is so much inequality, or why we had a financial crisis, is because of greed. There is a lot of greed, and that's a bad thing, and we have to get rid of greed. And the answer that I try to give, which is, you know, a little bit provocative, is that there's nothing wrong with greed. What's wrong is that we don't have the institutions to channel that greed into something productive.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, if you know, Steve Jobs wasn't greedy, we would not have all of these wonderful Apple technologies. That was just pure blind greed that he had. He wanted to dominate everything. But he didn't dominate it in the same way that Stalin did, or Pol Pot did, or, you know, or Carlos Slim did in Mexico, by monopolizing things and not letting anybody enter into the market. He did it by creating better products.
That's such an important point, Duran. Because, you know, human beings are on the spectrum. You know, it's in our inner ape. I keep using this expression, a bipolar ape, but we are on this broad spectrum, capable of doing terrible things and great things. And I really do agree with you that we need institutions that can channel the darker side into, and that's kind of, you know, that the best example of that is capitalism and is democracy. For the most part, there are problems with it, but that's something, you know, when we're talking about transgender stuff. When I saw Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair and said, "Call me Kate," I'm a liberal guy. I just am. I'm a live and let live guy. I've always been that way. I just believe in fair play. I'm not liberal that way. I just believe in fair play. But I saw it and I had a negative reaction. I kind of went, "Eh, that's annoying." Now, what happened there? I know exactly what happened. I tried to figure it out because I was trying to write a joke about it. Well, I wasn't given a chance by anybody to go, "Holy shit, this 65-year-old woman just turned into a 65-year-old Olympian. Bruce Jenner, I've known my whole life, is suddenly overnight is a 35-year-old woman." Don't act as though I'm supposed to think that's really normal and I'm not going to miss a beat and she's a lady now. Go fuck it. No, I'm allowed to be stirred, disturbed, maybe even freaked out. It doesn't mean I'm prejudiced against people who want to be transgender. It doesn't mean I'd ever censor anybody. It's not who I am. But I felt like the zeitgeist and the entire cultural movement was saying, "Hey, if you even blink, we're going to censor you. You're a transgender homophobe, et cetera, et cetera." And yeah. So I think that, Dacre, sometimes we are leaning in the direction of sort of making people compassionate. You know, the way my kids grew up in school, no touching, no dominant behavior. You got to be a sweetheart. And I just always go, boy, that is not very synonymous.
Well, it's a difficult balance, but I mean, I think it's very important that, you know, because we have these tendencies. So, you know, I think when we put it in the context of economics, you know, capitalism, greed, etc., I think that's easy. You know, it's not that everybody's going to accept it, but I think it's easy to see the boundaries of that argument. But I think that argument, and Dacre was also sort of hinting at that, I think that argument also applies to the political life, to the power, that just like greed, we have in the economic sphere, we have the power to dominate, to have our own voices heard, to have our, you know, wishes, political and social wishes, wherever they come from, imposed on others. And I think democracy is hard work, but it's feasible work because it channels these things into a way of having our voices heard while still listening to others, having our voices heard while we're trying to form coalitions around it rather than trying to sort of steamroll it by our own, you know, muscle power or military power. And also in the social arena, you know, that means that we have to refer, you know, perhaps we have, it means, I don't know whether it means, but I think it does mean that we have to also refrain from dominating other groups, you know, be they transgenders or racial minorities or
even the gentler spirits. I mean, even your artists
or a general
and stuff.
Spirit, yeah. Whatever they are, but we have to refrain from dominating them and creating them as the other group, so that, you know, those power dynamics don't play and those exclusionary dynamics don't play out very powerfully. And I think what, you know, many Western societies have, you know, not without problems, but they have succeeded over the last 30, 40 years. And here, I think Scandinavian countries have gone farther, and the UK has gone farther than the US. is sort of creating an environment in which you can still be an individual, you can still have your values, you can still have your opinions, but you don't try to sort of create, demonize other groups, and you don't try to dominate them, you don't try to sort of exclude them from public life and so on and so forth. And it's not an easy thing, and we're seeing the difficulties, you know, on another sort of difficult problem in Europe, for example, you know, integrating immigrants. It's been turned out to be very, very difficult. But leaving those sorts of difficulties aside, it has generally worked, and that sort of goes in the direction of, I think, what Thacker was saying and what you were saying, Brian, which is that we have become more compassionate because the institutions have sort of induced us to do so.
Yeah.
Dacher?
The thing I was actually going to say is I think it's really important, like, to tie all this together, right? Dacher, you've numerous times alluded to gossip, right? And that's the great leveling mechanism. We talk about other people. We say that they misbehaved. We support them. We do whatever. And that's how we manage and make sure that nobody gets out of control. And I think it's interesting in Why Nations Fail, you know, you really talk about politically and economically inclusive institutions. You don't just focus on democracy or the vote because it's a spectrum. How politically inclusive and how economically inclusive are you? And I think what Brian is talking about is basically political correctness. And the interesting thing is that, you know, there has been, in terms of those gossip mechanisms, there's been a real focus on what is publicly expressed, but that does not necessarily reflect an emotional correctness, right?
Yeah.
That there isn't the ability for honest communication necessarily because we all know what the prescribed ways of speaking are supposed to be, and does that sort of policing of speech become a limit on our ability to create an even more economically and even more politically inclusive society than the one we have today?
And Dacher, you work with Facebook, so I'm sure you deal with this a lot. I mean, don't you? I mean, you have a pretty big study group to look at.
Yeah, and I think that I think Facebook is grappling with what Duran is talking about, which is the great challenge of human social life, which is kind of this really striking balance that we can achieve between strong collectives that honor individual variation, right? And so, you know, we down at Facebook, we do a lot of work on kind of just the basic communicative processes by which people form ties, but at the same time harm each other. And it's it can use people like Duran, to be quite honest, where you need to think about kind of the historical sources of successful institutions and what are the parameters that make that really strike this balance between self-expression and then honoring the greater good. And it isn't easy.
Has anything surprised you about working with such a large control group as a social scientist?
At Facebook?
Yeah. Have you seen anything, human behavior that has been new for you, that has kind of shocked you?
Well, I'm struck at... I'm struck at how much people like pornography.
Well,
very surprising revelation. You know, yes. Who would have thought?
Well, not to me, man. I'm a pervert, so that makes total sense to me. But yeah,
I think
it's interesting because I think the success of Facebook has to do with how hungry we are for the social collective. Right. And how organically they arise and how they self-regulate and how real they are. So,
but it's also very interesting in the sense that it's also very liberating at some level. I mean, I'm not a Facebook user because it shows that we are very creative in creating that, in fashioning that social collective, you know, the view that's like, you know, the social collective is that, you know, 50 people who you grew up with who are exactly like you, that have the same ethnicity, they have the same prejudices, they have the same religious, you know, hang-ups as you. You know, that's the way that many people would have thought about it. And in some sense, you know, like intellectuals of the 1960s and the 70s, you know, they thought of this, you know, universal man that, you know, it would transcend ethnicity and so on and so forth. And we see that's not that easy. You know, people stick to their ethnic group, people stick to their social collectives, you know, people who are of Indian descent or Turkish descent or Chinese descent who are in, you know, California, Palo Alto, Silicon Valley, they still sort of hang on together even in the most sort of dynamic, fluid environment. So that might make you sort of think that the social collective is a very backward-looking thing, but the Facebook shows it's not. It's actually much broader. You can sort of create new, actually the online media more generally, you can create this whole new social collective of people with much more heterogeneous backgrounds than that you would have suggested.
Well, I'll tell you something else. Comedy, you know, when I look out in the audience, it's so many different faces. It's like the United Nations. They're all laughing at the same thing. It might be because I'm universally funny, you guys.
Yeah, Brian is making the case for
him. It might be. Yeah. Brian, yeah.
That's me.
Brian is making himself the case for himself as world president.
I think about it. And I will say that, you know, Darren, when I read your book, I'm always an optimist by nature. I read your book and it made me pessimistic. I got so depressed that so many countries don't have any kind of an institution that has integrity. Yeah. It's all rule by man. Very few countries enjoy the kind of freedoms that I do as an American. But then, Docker, your work makes me an optimist. So I'm kind of torn between both of you. And I wonder, it really is. I'm kind of pulled in both directions. I will say, just to piggyback, and I want to get both of your points of view on how optimistic you are about the future. But you know, I wanted to piggyback on something that, you know, you were talking about, Daron and Dockers. Matthew Arnold, I don't think he had access to the kind of neuroscience that we do today or anything, but Matthew Arnold said something really I never forgot. He said, you know, the United States is the country of the roaring stock market and the National Football League and, you know, and big guns and world, you know, just we're powerful and the strong-backed farmer. But if we're not careful, if we don't give quarter to the gentler spirits, if we don't give create a safe haven for those people who we would call different, weird, gay, whatever it might be, we may end up not being very interesting. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, if you want to be an interesting culture, you've gotta be compassionate. You've gotta protect individuals and individual expression.
And if you want to be,
don't agree with it.
And if you want to be an economically dynamic culture,
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
if you want to be rich, protect gay people.
Listen, I'm with you on that. I love one of the great lines in Daron. What is your colleague's name? I want to also credit
James
him.
Robinson.
And James Robinson, right. In both of your book, and Why Nations Fail, is I think you say something like, you can put a gun to a man's head and make him lift a box, but you can't put a gun to a man's head and make him have a great idea.
Right.
God damn, I wish I'd written that. I've quoted that about 1,000 times, too. People are like,
how many times have you credited it?
I don't credit him at all. Only because I forget the other author's name. It's not my fault. I'm trying to be egalitarian. I'm influenced by Dacher Kelman.
Plagiarism is the sincerest form of flattery.
Well, but Daron, I know that when last time we spoke, I said, have the world leaders like Putin read your book, damn it? And you said, no, but the sort of the second tier, the people that are below the Politburo in China, etc., those are the people that have read the book. And those are the people that it's had an influence on. Are you optimistic that the arguments you make in your book are going to permeate somehow to countries like, God, I don't know, the Sudan, etc.? I'm making hard cases here.
Not really super optimistic. I mean, you know, actually, I am also like you, Brian. I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
And if you, and, you know, when I wrote, you know, to be honest, I didn't perceive Why Nations Fail as a pessimistic book, because ultimately it says, you know, any country can build these inclusive institutions. And once you build these inclusive institutions, that's not an easy job to do, but it's been done several times. And it probably is, I thought I would have said, it's probably easier today to build them, to start building them, than it was, you know, 100 years ago. And once you build them, you can grow. You can grow very rapidly, and it will be a sort of a positive feedback process. Mm. But, you know, one thing that has made me much more pessimistic in the intervening 3 years since the publication of that book, or the 4.5 years since the writing of that book, is, you know, the international context. You know, we only pay lip service to international context because we just did not have enough time to get into it. But, you know, you know, what you see with ISIS or ISIL, whatever its new acronyms are, what you see with the Bashar al-Assad regime, you see the increasing tensions in the South China Sea. You see the war between Russia and Ukraine, which really is a war between Russia and Ukraine. You know, nothing else. And they are really sort of showing how difficult it is going to be to build a world order around inclusive institutions, because all of these nationalist feelings and all of the vestiges of what we call the extractive institutions that are going to have a much longer life in terms of influencing international economic and political dynamics. And those are the things that really make me sort of
Dacher, what do we do about that?
Less optimistic.
Dacher, I thought we were more compassionate. What's going on, man? What's going on? Is it only in America? Is it only up in Silicon Valley?
Yeah,
Putin is not getting any more compassionate, I'm afraid, right?
He needs to talk to Dacher.
Yeah, no, I mean, Duran's right. And I think that in the broader world context, there is this question of whether all these compassionate institutions are really, you know, Western European phenomena, and whether it's going to be a different game when it comes to other countries and the negotiations between them. I mean, I always end my teaching at Berkeley on, and it's an interesting question for Duran, which is, do institutions in their historical trajectories have compassionate directions, right? And I take stock of a lot of the great institutions that we celebrate, be it journalism or social collectives like Facebook, or for the most part, certain forms of criminal justice and how we punish people, even, you know, the nature of human rights within warfare, and all of those institutions in the broader historical sweep have become kinder with less harm inflicted. I don't know if Duran agrees, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is that there is no automatic tendency for institutions and our social organization to move in a more compassionate, more inclusive direction. Not at all. But I think there is a constant demand for more voice for people.
Yeah.
And that demand has become more institutionalized, more sort of well-organized over the last, you know, several decades because of the globalization of culture, because
yep.
of the better recognition that, you know, people like Mubarak or people like Mugabe are really doing a disservice and are doing, you know, terrible things to their populations. And those dynamics are changing things. It's really not yep. as easy today to be a dictator.
Because more people are watching. In other words, they've got to justify their behavior.
With the exception of whipping up nationalist fervor, you know, like Putin, with that exception, I think it's much harder today. And you see that, you know, in the 1960s, 30% of the world population, 30% of the world's countries were anything approaching a democratic regime. Today,
yeah.
you know, close to 70%.
Yeah.
You know, it's a major change in how we are, you know, and those democracies are not perfect. You know, there are democracies like Mexico or Argentina or, you know, Turkey or, you know, Ghana, which have a lot of problems, but it's still better than the alternatives. And,
yeah.
and we're moving in that direction.
So we are moving.
Yeah, so that's my basis for, you know, I mean, I'm optimistic in terms of local institutions, with the exception of inequality and a little bit of bias in criminal justice system. But, I mean, those are the kinds of data that lead me to feel more optimistic on the broader international scale, too.
I mean, I guess the more optimistic sort of view was sort of the picture was painted by Steve Pinker in his book,
yeah.
you know, Better Angels of Our Nature. And I guess he's trying to sort of articulate, although not every part of that argument is clear, but he's trying to articulate something where that change takes place both because of culture, because of other things which I would call institutions, perhaps even biology.
Yeah.
You know, I think it requires much more thinking, and it's definitely not a sort of a monotone process where we're always going in that direction. There are lots of hiccups, there are lots of reversals, but probably there is some truth to that.
Well, the argument, the ideas are winning the day. I mean, you're again, you know, it's people like you guys that are really answering these questions, or at least tackling these questions, and I think it does permeate the idea. I mean, you guys sit there in a room and write a book for 3 years. It must be pretty daunting to think all this thought. What if nobody reads this goddamn thing? But, you know, but the fact is...
Brian, do you have that worry about your stand-up?
Oh, no, because I'm so universal.
Oh, that's
and
right.
By the way, I get up on stage with a mic and shout at you, but...
Are you the universal man, Brian?
I'm going to be after this podcast. But, you know, that is what I appreciate. Yes, we went from 30% to 70%, you know, democracy. It probably because that's a very hard argument to work against. And I think a lot of the work that you're dealing with, Dacher, in your book and the people you cite, I mean, the neuroscience and biology is on, time is on your side, as they say, I think. You have to be pretty happy with that. I mean, it seems to me that it's, we are better to embrace the better angels of our nature because it's where the gold lies, not there. In them, there are hills. See how I'll bring a Western motif into high intellectual discourse. Jesus Christ! I like when I talk because I can see Dacher's face and he's got an ironic smile. my child, keep going, my child. Keep thinking and trying to articulate your thoughts. Yeah. Keep parroting my
Carry
book.
On.
Carry on, boy. Carry on.
Well, I should have had the screen on also to see this these facial expressions.
Well, yeah, and plus, you know, I've got the best body in comedy, so you should treat yourself.
We're actually about to interview Dacher's former professor, Paul Ekman, and he specifically said that we needed to video Skype with him so that he could watch us and see our micro-expressions.
I'm nervous.
Guys are in trouble.
But yeah, I wanted to go back to, like, Dacher, you were sort of alluding to this historical process, right? That we start off in these band-level societies, and then, you know, as societies reach a certain size, you know, they move towards authoritarianism. And now we're seeing a move back towards egalitarianism. Is that not a function of communication technology? Because the mechanisms for leveling and maintaining egalitarianism are gossip. And when you have 150 people in a tribe, it's quite easy to gossip about everybody in the tribe. But when you have a society that is large enough that it covers all of Greece, you know, and you're stuck in, you know, 500 BC, there's no way that you can, you know, see the leader. You can't check their authority. You can't make up nicknames about them. You can't, you know, effectively police that. And then as we've seen, you know, the printing press and all these other technologies come into place, you start to be able to return to what existed at the level of the tribe.
Yeah, you know, I mean, thanks for bringing that up. I mean, I've early studies of, you know, democracies in hunter-gatherer groups really talked about the power of really surprisingly, you know, behaviors that we often think about skeptically or derisively, like gossip and sort of damaging the individual's reputation, and how much of early social life was revolved around that kind of public commentary and the controlling of others' reputations. And it's interesting, you know, I just finished up a book on power and did a lot of scholarship on Niccolo Machiavelli, who had quite a coercive model of social power that we've been talking about. And during that era, you know, most people couldn't, you know, they couldn't read, there were no printing presses, they couldn't comment on leaders' behaviors. And so this basic means of commentary and scrutiny and criticism and satire, right, and comedy, John Stewart and the like, is so critical to power and how we keep in check these kind of, quote, darker tendencies of the human mind. So, yeah, I think it's, I began as a young person being very skeptical of the media and, you know, worried in a kind of a Noam Chomsky way about their biases. And I've really come to a much different view about how critical and vital they are, those as institutions.
Yeah. And so in that sense, I mean, if the ability to return to those democratic tendencies is being driven by communication technologies and the ease of information moving, then it would seem that the historical trend is really on our side, right?
Yeah.
It is. And it leads to these really counterintuitive...
Sorry, I didn't want to.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people that, you know, since I do work at Facebook, people feel like Facebook and the extent to which now our behavior is publicly visible and our reputations are at stake and the like, that actually is pernicious to healthy social life. And more recent social science says, you know, when we're aware of our reputations, when people have the capacity to comment on them and share that information, it's one of these forms of hard work that occasionally is painful that is good for strong social collectives. So I embrace those kinds of social communication.
I think that's absolutely correct that, you know, the new online technologies give a sort of tremendous set of new tools. But I think, again, the reality is probably a little bit more nuanced that, you know, so some of these tools are being used very effectively by repressive governments to sort of silence dissent. You know, in China, for example, I think the balance has to be that the online medium has done more to sort of solidify the control of the Communist Party than, you know, lead to a flourishing free expression. And also, some of these tools do bring out the worst in people because they they enable sort of anonymous or semi-anonymous, you know, unreasonable criticisms, bullying, and all of those sorts of things because, you know, they give a sort of a way out from the, you know, the tighter reputational sort of concerns that people would have in their daily interactions and being aggressive towards certain views or certain people.
Hmm.
But I think that it's also partly that this is a new and emergent technology and we haven't fully figured out how to use it yet.
Right. Exactly.
And we,
again, it's a question of how we channel all of those into the better.
Right.
100%. But in terms of that, you know, global order that is based on political or economically inclusive institutions, when you have the internet, you finally have the underlying technology that makes that really possible. Whereas if you're relying on the steamship and, you know, the printing press, you simply don't have the level of communication, the ability to coordinate, the ability to have that effective information transfer. So it's, I think, the adjacent possible of all of this communication technology is that we may finally figure out to build those sort of institutions that you've laid out in Why Nations Fail on a much, much larger scale.
Yeah. I totally agree with that, that the possibilities are positive and endless. Yeah.
Daron, what are you working on right now?
Well, you know, I'm working on a bunch of things, you know, papers, academic papers. But the big sort of issue that I'm working on is sort of actually relates to some of the things that we're talking about today. And it's something, you know, James and I touched on in Why Nations Fail, which is how do you actually build states that have the capacity to do good things, like provide public services, enforce a level playing field, do the right sort of regulation, have the unbiased justice system. And it's not an easy question. You know, one view would be, oh, you know, that's just an engineering problem. Just in the same way that Facebook has to have, you know, just the right engineering solution to creating the right platform, the states have to form their sort of teams, their instruments so that they have the greatest capacity. And what James and I argue in a series of papers, and now, you know, this is sort of the basis of sort of a new book we're trying to work on, is, you know, it's actually a sort of a deeply political problem, too, that sort of state capacity building does require an institutional development where those who are, you know, controlling the state, its bureaucrats, its politicians, also have the trust of the society and are accountable to society, because when that's absent, there will be a lot of ways in which society can thwart their efforts to build that capacity. It's a little bit like, you know, the gossip or the witchcraft that we were talking about, which, you know, you can apply to people in a small society in order to prevent them from accumulating that power and become the big chief. Well, you have many modern versions of that, or we have many ancient versions of that throughout history, which is going to prevent the states from building that capacity, because you don't want a state, you know, dominated by Bashar al-Assad or Mugabe or the Chinese Communist Party to have too much capacity. And that sort of settles into a very distorted equilibrium where you have all these states that are states only in names because they can't do all of the good things. They can only do the repression.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's the challenge.
It's a book I'll be reading.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the challenge. I look forward to reading that book.
And Dacher, you have a book that you just finished, but I don't think it's come out yet. Is that correct?
Yeah, so May 2016, Happy to Come Back, it'll be called The Power Paradox, and it reflects kind of the deeper, complex tensions in the human mind that we've been talking about, which is, in many ways, social groups tend to give power to individuals who advance the greater good, but then the seductions and dopamine rushes of power make us act like assholes. So, you know, how do we
kind of the devil and the angel guys? Huh? I think it was all written. I think it was all written in the Bible. What the hell you guys are talking about?
No, exactly. So, how do we think about, you know, striking a healthy balance in those tendencies.
Yeah.
So I look forward to reading it, Tucker.
I'm gonna put in a democratic vote on behalf of you guys writing a book together.
That would be an honor.
Yeah. Because,
oh yeah. I mean, I'll be the beneficiary of that.
Well, because I think that's the thing. You know, we've started there has been that bleed, certainly in behavioral economics, between the neuroscience and the psychology and the economics, but I have yet to find a really good book that draws on really strongly on the neuroscience and the psychology, and then really strongly on the economics, the politics, the history, and really.
I think that's right. I think there isn't one.
Sounds like you guys better get to work.
You know, and when you guys speak at Davos, just give a nod to Hunter and Brian.
We'll be in the front. We'll be in the front row, rubber banding our underwear on the stage.
Yeah.
Dacher Kellner is the author of Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and The Compassionate Instinct. And of course, Daron Acemoglu and his co-author,
James Robinson.
James Robinson wrote a great book called Why Nations Fail. If you want to learn a little bit about a lot, I don't even know what that means. Pick up both those books. You both really are authors and thinkers that I recommend to people all the time. When people say, hey, what should I read first, or what should I get involved in? I always say, well, I don't know what you should read first, but you better get these two under your belt. And I'm glad I have you under my belt.
Thank you, Brian.
Although, you know, you're not my type, neither one of you. But anyway, yeah, you guys are something else, man. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I find it a privilege just to be able to listen to you guys and try to talk to you. So
this was fun.
Yeah.
It was our pleasure to be here. It was really productive conversation. I learned a lot.
Good. Keep thinking and keep writing. We need you.
And write together.
Write together.
All right, Dacher, I'm going to email you.
Good.
All right, Daron.
See you guys.
All right.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you, Brian.
Bye.
See you.
Talk to you guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks
see
so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Awesome.
Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. A couple of very smart guys. And I do.
Are you talking about the professors or us, Brian?
No, us. The professors, please. Those guys just sit around and think about things. And it is. Those are two guys where you think to yourself, I wish the whole world could read their work, or at least be exposed to their arguments, because the world would be different.
Yeah. And also, if they wrote a book together, imagine that book. By their powers combined, it'd be like Captain Planet.
Yeah. I don't know what Captain Planet is.
Well, that's because you're old, Brian.
Ah, shit. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's our time. Thank you so much for tuning in to the greatest show on Earth.
Wow.
The Brian Hunter.
No, you see, you should have said the greatest show on Earth and then taken full credit.
I know.
You do it, Brian.
I pause.
Say it again. Do it again.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for tuning in to the greatest show on Earth, the Brian Callen Show.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.